I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a Friday conversation, a memoir about growing up in the 50s with a family of fugitives. What made them run? But first, classes are still canceled. The campus of Delaware State University remains in lockdown after two students were wounded in an early morning shooting at Delaware State University in Dover, Delaware. Andrea Boyle is a reporter for WHYY Radio and TV. She's at the site, joins us now for an update. Andrea, first of all, what's the latest word from officials on the two shooting victims, a male and a female?
Actually, there's been little word from officials around here. So far, we know that the male student is in stable condition and the female student is in serious condition, and they said she possibly has life-threatening injuries. And as far as the suspect, there's been no word about who the suspect is or even a real description, no word if it's male or female, anything of that nature, and the campus is still on lockdown.
Of course, if there's no word about the shooter, there's a chance that the shooter's still on the campus.
There is. They said they cannot confirm that the shooter is not on campus. They have taken a tally of all the students who are on campus, but there is no official word of whether or not the suspect is there or not.
Well, this, of course, follows the horrendous shooting last April at Virginia Tech. The administration there faced a lot of criticism for the way it handled that event, especially for the way it failed to notify students initially. Let's listen to a telephone message that the Delaware State School sent out today.
Until the suspect is apprehended, students, faculty, and staff are being directed to remain in their buildings until further notice.
Now, Andrea, the school, this is Delaware State, has not said, you know, what their system is, but what have you gleaned as to how they notified students?
I spoke to a student who had kind of wandered across the street to where the media is, across the street from the university. He said that the resident assistants went door-to-door in the residence halls, making sure everyone was there, making sure everyone knew, and that was roughly about 1 a.m. yesterday, pretty close to the time of the incident. Other than that, they have been notified via the website. There's a posting on the university's main website. But there is no cellular or text messaging service to let the students know. I know that's been a popular thing at some universities. But here at Del State, they have not implemented that system.
In fact, the University of Delaware, the other large school in the state, has implemented a text messaging notification system. But Delaware State obviously had some sort of phone message. Do we know yet how that phone message that we just heard got to kids?
The phone message was supposed to have gone to the dorm rooms. So from what I've been told, when you picked up the phone to make a phone call, you would hear that message rather than hearing a dial tone.
So you'd hear that. So as far as you could tell, they didn't have the system that other schools are experimenting with, where you'd actually be woken up by your cell phone, perhaps with a phone call. This shooting comes even as this campus is still grieving for the three Delaware State students and one incoming student who were killed when they were hanging out in a playground in their hometown of Newark. That happened August 4th. And we know the university began its year with a memorial service for those students. Is there any sense that the two shootings might be connected?
No, there's no sense of that at all. It's just a matter of it's another hard event to happen to students of this university.
Right.
There's no indication that they are connected in any way. In fact, I think everyone from every suspect in the Newark shooting has been arrested.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, the campus is locked down. You said you just talked to a student who wandered across the street. Is there a sense that kids are staying in their classes, or what is the scene there?
Well, there's no classes, but they're staying in their rooms. It seems that that's the case. There is at least one dining hall open. The dorms kind of sit off to one side, and then where the shooting was in front of Memorial Hall, which is the basketball arena, is kind of on a main mall there. That's cordoned off with police tape. And so the student said to me that you weren't really allowed to go near the crime scene, but you could, you know, get out of the dorm. You weren't staying inside the room. You're allowed to wander on the campus a little bit. But from what we've seen, there's not a lot of that going on. It's very quiet. One man who was an employee at the university had gone in and then come back out. And when he spoke to us, he said it was very desolate, very unlike the way the university normally is.
Andrea Boyle, reporter for WHYY Radio and TV. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you. Well, on Fridays, we sometimes turn over time to just plain interesting stories, and here's one. When reporter Michael Connor was growing up, he knew that his parents were hiding some sort of deep secret. He came to call it the danger, with a capital D. It would cause Mike, his parents, and two sisters to repeatedly, completely uproot, abandon pets and friends and furniture, and run. In a reverse of today's illegal immigration stories, the blonde, blue-eyed O'Connors, mom from Britain, dad from Boston, would run illegally from the U.S. into Mexico, something that Mike and his sisters Mary and Fiona had to accept without ever speaking about it out loud.
As a small boy, I decided to believe the stories my parents told me, even though I knew they weren't true. I understood that part of our mystery was the danger, which could crush our family if we ever stopped running and turned to look at it. I learned from the beginning that our safety came only with believing our parents' lies about our family and joining them in refusing to acknowledge the danger. Still, the danger was always there, and I could never hope to understand it. I could only make sure that it never got close enough to throw its shadow on me.
Mike tried to escape the danger by going to school, marrying, building his own family, and a career as an international reporter for the New York Times and National Public Radio. But after both of his parents died, Mike used his skills as a reporter to go back to investigate what it was that caused his parents to be so afraid. He now shares what he found in the new book, Crisis, Pursued by Disaster, followed closely by Catastrophe, a memoir of life on the run. And Mike joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hello.
And we should say, speaking of family, in addition to working for NPR and being married to Tracy Wilkinson of the Los Angeles Times, a frequent guest on the program, your son is sitting to your left. He's a producer with the NPR show Only a Game, which is produced over the cubicle wall, Gabe, from where we work on Here and Now. And Gabe's going to weigh in on the story in a minute, too. So welcome to you, Gabe.
Thank you.
And Mike, take us back to your childhood. Your English mom and your dad, born in Boston, they met it during the war.
The Second World War.
When did you know that there was something funny going on?
Remarkably, to me, I think it's remarkable. I could tell that as early as four. The way our parents reacted to police, to authority, with fear, but then denying the fear, that I knew that there was something funny in our background, and we didn't want to be caught.
And yet, it was never spoken what it was. I mean, your mother always acted, she seemed lovely, and she always acted as if you were on a picnic. Everything was this delightful adventure.
An adventure, exactly right.
But somehow you got the message that you were to lie or feign certain things. I mean, give some examples of what you were doing as a kid, even though no one told you what was wrong.
Well, simple things. We had friends, but our friends didn't come into our house. We had a house, but it wasn't in a neighborhood. It was in a kind of down a lonely pine road in Texas. And the larger things of accepting that our parents were always right, even though they said things that didn't make sense. For instance, we rushed off to Mexico on a moment's notice, leaving everything in the house behind, leaving our dog, our precious poor prince, behind. Yeah. For some nonsense about dad needing to start a new business there, and wouldn't it be wonderful to have a great adventure in Mexico?
And you were heartbroken, and so was your mother, but you guys still fled.
Well, it told me if we had to run so quickly and so haphazardly that we had to leave Prince behind, then it told me we were really in some kind of serious trouble. And I was about 12 then, I guess, 11 or 12. So I knew then that whatever was behind us was really dangerous.
Right. And you ended up in, you know, sometimes life-threatening situations, it seemed, you know, traveling across the desert in cars that were falling apart. You break your arm one of the times you fled to Mexico, and your mom can't go to the hospital with you.
She was afraid of going to some place where she would be noticed and questions would be asked.
You and your little sister were told to go catch a bus and go to school once in one of the cities you lived in Mexico, and you're lost and begging for money and trying to get on the bus, and you're two little kids.
Yeah, it was tough. I don't think I'm being too easy on my parents when I say it was tough for them to adopt to a foreign country, in this case Mexico, with foreign culture and foreign ways of doing things and a foreign language where they had little money to spare and no reserve to fall back on. It was difficult for them. And so they probably asked us to do more than they should have asked us to do.
Well, we find that out later. But as we're reading, Mike, you know, you put the reader, I think, in the position of that 4-year-old or 8-year-old or 12-year-old, because the whole time I'm thinking, what is it? Why are they running? How bad could it be? Did he murder someone? Did she murder someone? This must have been what you felt like.
Oh, those are our questions, too. Mary, my sister, who's 4 years younger than I, and I would muse about this. What in the world are they running from? Are we running from? Was it a mafia? Something happened with the mafia? Mm-hmm. Was it a bank robbery? Was there a murder or a horrible hit-and-run accident? What are we running from?
Yeah. Then later, as you get older, still, no one's telling you why, but it's hard to apply to colleges because colleges want records. Your lives all become very hard until everybody just sort of splits off. All the kids, going off trying to make your way. You have a child with your girlfriend. You decide to marry, which enrages your father, which is sort of a clue there. There's something about the fact that you were marrying young that really enrages him. It seemed like a real big moment.
It was. I mean, I never seen him that way. He was so angry. He couldn't control himself. And I didn't know at the time, of course, what was driving him like this.
Right.
It turns out he had a marriage prior to the one that I knew about, and it was an unhappy marriage, at least from his standpoint. And he thought that I was running the same risk again.
That becomes the first thing that you discover. Your father had another family with children. And this is part of what becomes your investigation. After you become an investigative journalist, you work around the world, you cover wars, your parents die, and you start to uncover the mystery through a box that your mother left. What was in the box?
Well, it was a cigar box, a kind of battered Tampa Nugget Sublimes cigar box. It had the only documentary evidence my mother had of anything we'd done. It had photographs from 1940. It had a receipt for a county tax payment for the house we had in Houston, Texas, a house we fled and abandoned. Some travel documents my mother had gotten just after the Second World War. So it had some little leads, tips that I could use to begin to investigate us.
You'd always known, I mean, it's odd, because you'd always known there were some relatives, some relatives back in Boston. Come to find out, as we said, your dad had not just the family left behind and the two children, but his whole immediate family. What'd they tell you?
It was an extraordinarily close family. They were Irish, South Shore Boston Irish, mm-hmm. and the Catholic Church, the rules of the Catholic Church were the guidelines for my grandmother and my father's mother. So when he married fairly young and decided that the marriage was not good, his mother couldn't accept that. And she did what she could to keep the family together, his first family.
Well, and you find out from relatives that to try to make your father stay with his first family, your grandmother confronted your mom and told her she had to leave him, even though she had you, then just a little infant. And when your mom didn't say she'd leave your dad, your grandmother called the authorities?
Called the INS, called the Immigration Service, because my grandmother saw as this foreigner is trying to ruin a good American Catholic, Irish Catholic marriage.
So was that a part of it? I mean, now we have two things, perhaps, that your dad left behind another family. Perhaps the INS was looking for your mom, who he said came from Britain. Was there something else?
Yeah, it was something much bigger than the INS. First of all, the INS was kind of lethargical about it. They went through the process. I've gotten the file. They went through the process of telling my mother she shouldn't be here, and she said, okay, fine, I'll leave. And they said, okay, well, when you do, let us know. And it was very, very simple. They didn't even take her fingerprints. But the bigger problem was the FBI.
Now, why would the FBI be pursuing Michael Connor's family? We'll find out after the break. Later, the only atheist congressman in America. That's all coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with journalist Mike O'Connor and Mike's son, Gabe O'Connor, a producer for NPR's Only a Game. He's about to jump in. Mike's, though, been telling us about growing up on the run with his fugitive family. And ironically, he would grow up to report on refugees in the Balkans and elsewhere, seeing quickly abandoned homes looking just like his when he was a kid. He tells his story in the new book, Crisis, Pursued by Disaster, Followed Closely by Catastrophe, a memoir of life on the run. Mike, before the break, you were telling us your British mother was being tracked by the INS, but you ended with a little bombshell there. The FBI was also after your mother. Why?
The FBI was interested in my mother because she had attended some services or meetings, sermons at the Community Church of Boston. And the FBI director, Hoover, considered that church a front for communism. Well, at the very time my mother went to the meetings, Hoover tells his agents in the field, that place is a front for commies, go and find me the evidence.
What year, around what time was this?
It was 46, mm-hmm. last 3 months of 46. Mm-hmm. So the FBI had an undercover informant there, a guy named Herbert Philbrick, And his job was to turn to the FBI and the names of the people who went to services and meetings and seminars and the like. And so he turned my mother's name in. And so the FBI was after her. That was the real problem.
He's left a family. She perhaps has some INS slightly interested, but she thinks they're maybe more interested than they are. And definitely the FBI is interested. But still, I came to the same conclusion you did towards the end of the book. You still find yourself thinking, well, couldn't they have worked this out? Isn't there? I mean, it got so bad for you guys.
And every day it got worse. They compounded their problems. You know, they became fugitives. They didn't pay their income taxes because they didn't want the federal government to find out where they were living, and on and on. And, well, I think the reason is, and I'm satisfied with this analysis, that in those years, from the late 40s to the early 1970s, there was such a hysterical fear of communism, of foreigners, of people not like us in our country trying to hurt us, that was fanned by Hoover and others. Important people with connections, Hollywood writers and the like, were being slapped down and having their careers ruined. And my parents, I believe, would have felt that they had no chance to combat that, mm-hmm. that there was no deal they could make with the government that would, it would keep them out of jail.
And there was real hysteria at the time. But then did a part of it, you think, was a part of it existing in your parents' heads?
I can't deny that. You know, certainly when you're on the run for a long time, you do become paranoid. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way you stay away from being caught is to react at the slightest noise.
And then, of course, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
Exactly. They may well have overreacted, but they may well have become paranoid. But I'm not sure they started that way.
Gabe O'Connor, I want to bring you in. Gabe, Mike's son again, our coworker, our colleague. Did you see the impact? Your dad writes about how this impacted him in his life, the things that he did, the way he lived his life, the way he... What would you say, Mike, that you were always, even when you were doing well, you were worried?
I was always afraid that it was going to end tomorrow.
Yeah.
Because it always did when I grew up.
Right. Did you feel that in your dad before he made all these discoveries?
No, not really, because I was living that life. I mean, you know, this is how my dad was. I mean, he was not there all that often. Being a reporter, and this is the life. I mean, much like how he got used to it, he must have figured, you know, that this is how everyone lives. Well, this is how we're supposed to live. This is how it's supposed to be.
And it was, Mike, you were mimicking your own dad because your own dad would go off on these schemes where he was going to make all this money. And meanwhile, you and your mom, when you were a child in Mexico, had no money. You were starving. And he had disappeared. So in a funny way, even though you were doing good work, you were disappearing too.
Yeah, and I think I was running from the past still. And Gabe saw a father being driven in part by journalism. Okay, that's good. But also in part by the need to keep on moving.
Yeah. Gabe, I don't know where, you know, how the chronology of the discoveries, you know, where you were along there. Did you suddenly find more family as your dad found more family? How'd that work?
I found them when I moved out to Boston. You know, I'm originally from the Bay Area, and I, you know, moved out here about 10 years ago now. And when I first moved out here, I actually lived with my Aunt Fiona.
Who's your dad's sister.
And so, you know, when it was announced that my dad was going to be doing this book about the family, it was funny. I sat down with Fiona and we, you know, talked for about 2 hours. And she gave me the outline of what he initially discovered and some of the stories that are in this book. And I, you know, I remember just sitting there going, they did what? Who? FBI? Mexico? What? After the 2 hours, I remember going outside and just like just taking a deep breath and going, oh, man, what did I miss?
Isn't that interesting, Mike? Because your son ends up having the same experience you did. I mean, if you hadn't broken that cycle, you have another generation and your son saying, what happened?
Right, right.
Yeah. But why didn't you ever tell Gabe, since nobody had ever told you your story, why didn't you ever tell Gabe, you know, I had a really weird life?
I can't explain that or justify it, but it's one of those things. It was a taboo in our family growing up.
Gabe's nodding yes.
And to look further or explain to Gabe that there was more to it than I could explain would have violated that taboo.
Do you think you found out everything?
No.
Yeah.
I got a lot of files from the federal government. It took years to get the files. They were extremely difficult to get. The government was extremely difficult to deal with. And there, I would love to get a few files more, but which they're not going to give me. And in a story like this, it's so long, it goes back so many years, it covers several countries, a lot of people are dead, you don't know what you're not getting. I'm satisfied that I've gotten all I can find, but I'm not sure there isn't something else out there.
That's the way I feel reading it. Like, okay, an abandoned family, and the INS, the FBI, allegations of communism, you know, unpaid taxes and, you know, unpaid bills and everything that happened after that. You still feel there's something else, some other reason they were
It could be. Although I think that the anti-communist or anti-even leftist, just political thought, was so strong in the United States in those years that it really, if you needed an excuse to keep running, you just had to read the front page of the local paper and look who they're going after now, and it might have kept you going.
Yeah. I want to thank you both. Michael Connor, the book is Crisis, Pursued by Disaster, Followed Closely by Catastrophe, which, by the way, is something your father once wrote about one of their misadventures.
Exactly.
Yeah. Michael Connor and his son Gabe O'Connor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next week on Here Now, Padraig O'Malley. He got enemies in Northern Ireland and South Africa to talk. Now he's doing the same thing in Iraq. That's next week. Still ahead today, the only openly atheist U.S. congressman. All of this after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, for a fifth time, Senate Democrats tried to pass a version of the Levin-Reed Amendment, a measure drafted by Michigan's Carl Levin and Nevada's Harry Reid, to set a timetable for withdrawal of troops from Iraq. But it failed again, capping a week of disappointments for Democrats. Yesterday, the Senate blocked legislation that would have cut off funding for the war next June. Wednesday, the Senate rejected a proposal that would have limited troop deployments in Iraq. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News. Rick, some would say, why are the Democrats continuing to push these bills when it seemed early in the week that they were pretty much doomed?
Well, the short answer is that the left of their party is pushing them so hard that they'd be pretty much pilloried if they gave up at this point, even if they know they don't have the votes, and I think it's pretty clear at this point that they don't. There are so many liberals in this country and liberal activist groups like MoveOn.org who are clamoring for an end. They feel like Congress was elected and Democratic Congress was elected to end the war. They want to see Democrats go through the motions, put pressure on Republicans, even if they are doomed to fail.
Well, we're seeing, some sort of a turning point here. The Levin-Reed Amendment actually got less support today than it did earlier in the summer. Today, 47 senators voted for it. In July, 52 did. What's happening here?
Well, I think what's happening is there's a lot of pressure on moderate Republicans, in particular people who are up for re-election next year, to come around and start to support a pullout in the war and a new strategy than the president has supported. However, it should be noted that these numbers are not as high as a lot of people thought. A few months ago, it looked like by the time we got to September, there'd just be a clamor in Congress from members of both parties to end the war, that there could be even 60 votes, which would be enough to advance legislation in the Senate. That has not happened. Nothing is getting 60 votes.
Well, how much of this is what we're hearing is a huge backlash over the ad taken up by MoveOn.org last week? It referred to General Petraeus as General Betrayus. The Senate yesterday passed a resolution condemning the ad. Their critics would say managing to change the debate about a debate over the war to a debate over an ad.
I think that was really significant. We had at least one Republican senator that I had heard, Gordon Smith from Oregon, saying they shot themselves in the foot. And he was a Republican senator that's prepared to support the Democrats. But I think what happened with the MoveOn.org ad is, and that may have been good for the liberal base, and MoveOn's donations have gone up in the wake of that, but it's forced Republicans, or it's allowed Republicans, to unite against a common enemy, and that enemy is the liberal left. And that's not even against the policy as much as against the politics of it. And they come together and are able to hold together, I think, better than they would have otherwise, in large part because of MoveOn.org's move.
Well, on the other hand, we should note, after today's vote, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said that Republicans and President Bush now fully own the war in Iraq.
Yeah, and I think the counter to that is that they owned it 6 months ago and 3 years ago and 4 years ago, and that nothing has substantially changed on that. There's a lot of pressure, as I mentioned, on the Democrats to make as much political hay out of this as possible. But I think there's a significant danger here for Democrats if they continue to push legislation that doesn't have a chance of passing. Voters are going to say, look, both of these parties aren't getting anything done. Why did we elect these Democrats? We see record low approval ratings, not just for President Bush, but also for the Democratic Congress. So there is some political risk, although this is still clearly the Republicans' war and the Republicans' liability.
And briefly, can the Democrats move this debate into the House more successfully?
Yes. The short answer is yes, they can. There isn't the same 60% threshold that you need to advance legislation in the House, so there's a good chance of approving some things in the House, but because everyone knows things are going to die in the Senate, it only has a symbolic impact, and it'll allow Republicans to say, look, you're wasting time making meaningless votes here when really the troops need the support of the Congress and of the American people. So there's a lot of danger still for Democrats. They like to make a lot of the fact that they've changed the course a bit, but folks really wanted to see more by now.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. Rick, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, there are 535 members of Congress, and only one of them is on record as saying he does not believe in a supreme being. Atheism in America is a conversation we had on yesterday's program, and we continue it today with that lone congressman. Pete Stark, Democrat, who represents California's 13th congressional district, joins us. Congressman, you spoke before a humanist organization at Harvard last night. They say it's the first ever public remarks from a lawmaker about avowed atheism. So why are you, you know, as they're saying, coming out now about this issue?
Robin, it's as much a surprise to me as it might be to your listeners. I filled out a form for an organization that's very involved in separation of church and state. And in that, they happened to ask my religion and my beliefs. I just mentioned I'm a Unitarian who doesn't happen to believe in a supreme being.
And so there you are. But you know, let's explain, because you're a Unitarian, and Unitarians embrace all beliefs, even a non-belief in God.
Many Unitarians know exactly what they don't believe.
Right. There you go. Well, you know that you're, you know, speaking, and even if it's by accident, at a time when it feels as if politicians are increasingly being pushed to talk about their faith in God.
Well, unhappily, I think many of my colleagues pander to an extreme group of evangelicals who would like to impose religious beliefs on our laws and on our country, and that's troubling to me.
Well, your district in the San Francisco Bay Area is one of the most liberal in the country. Do you think if you were running in a more conservative area, a conservative area in middle America, could you get elected after coming out as an atheist?
No, I don't, nor do I think in North Dakota, where the only political concerns they would have there are God, guns, and gays. I mean, there are areas of the country, the Bible Belt in the South, Kansas, for heaven's sake. Yeah, there are places in the country where people would take strong exception to a non-believer.
And do they have their right to that, you know, to their beliefs?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned, you know, Americans and how they feel. A national poll conducted by the University of Minnesota researchers, Americans rated atheists below Muslims, recent immigrants, and other minority groups.
And right below used car salesmen, I suspect.
When it came to sharing a vision of American society. Now, that's different. I mean, that's, you know, saying that you don't share the same values and vision of American society. How do you feel about that? What would you want to tell someone you do believe in?
I believe in the humanity of man. I believe that we all want to live together in peace. I think that love transcends all the differences that any of us might have. I believe there's a wonderful order to our universe, and if we don't screw it up by having global warming, nature will continue to provide us with a wonderful environment in which to live and grow and raise our children, and that the memories of the people who worked so hard to build a better society will live on for a long time. And I guess that's probably my definition of heaven on earth.
And when a session is open with a prayer or the Pledge of Allegiance on Capitol Hill, what do you do?
If I'm there, I stand silently so I don't interrupt anybody else's prayer. Just like I'd wish your listeners happy Yom Kippur today, in the Pledge of Allegiance, I managed to skip over under God. I learned in the 30s as a young boy that wasn't in our Pledge of Allegiance, and I tend not to try and interrupt anybody else's wanting to worship or present their views in any way they'd like.
Pete Stark represents California's 13th Congressional District, is the first openly atheist member of Congress. He spoke before the humanist organization at Harvard last night. Congressman Stark, thanks for your time.
And I guess, Robin, rather than bless you, can I say may the force be with you.
Yes, you may.
Have a nice day.
You too. And if you missed yesterday's conversation about the growing number of American atheists, you can just go to our website, here-now.org, click on the archives, and while there you can download a podcast. Take us with you wherever you go, here-now.org. Before we go today, a view of World War II through the bloody, muddy windshield of an ambulance. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, let's take a moment for some of your thoughts. And many of you wrote after our conversation yesterday with Greg Epstein, the humanist chaplain at Harvard. He wants to establish a gathering place for atheists, but some atheists say that sounds dangerously like a church. Well, Mary Scriver of Valier, Montana writes, "Humanism was my dad's favorite religion in Manitoba in the 30s. Prairie humanists were kidded about having grain elevators for cathedrals. There are at least three pre-existing American denominations that already serve humanism: Ethical Culture, the American Humanist Association, and, as we just heard, the Unitarian Universalist Association. Some say there's no danger of organized religion because all three of these groups are pretty disorganized." To Iraq, we've noted on the program how President Bush and others compare the conflict in Iraq to America's Civil War. Well, Nancy Stanley of Billings, Montana writes, "We did not resolve our Civil War or civil rights issues with the governments of England and France occupying our land. Let's get out of Iraq and deal with the results as they happen." Yesterday, we spoke with a newspaper editor in Louisiana about the huge protest in support of the so-called Gina Six, young black men charged in the beating of a white student. Dan Danvira of Portland, Oregon, was disappointed.
Instead of interviewing a reporter or someone who could give both sides of the story, or interviewing someone from the black community, you decided to let the white power structure of Gina defend itself.
Well, Dan, thanks for giving us another opportunity to say we had lined up a reporter traveling with protesters from Detroit, but right before air, cell phone towers in tiny Gina were overwhelmed and we lost the call. Okay, who knew clotheslines would be so provocative? Yesterday we spoke with Susan Taylor from Bend, Oregon. The developers of her subdivision are telling her she must take down her clothesline. Kip Childs from Lake Oswego, Oregon, says yes, there are regulations against such unsightly obstructions, and writes, "I'm an environmentalist, and I previously served on the board of a homeowners association in the Bend area. What about the guy who thinks he's got a right to drive his dirt bike around the development at all hours? Or the other guy who wants to cover the woodpile in his backyard with blue tarps? As a board member, I've had to deal with all of these situations, and I can assure you, it is a nightmare." Well, the bulk of the huge response was along these lines.
"I was absolutely shocked out of my mind. I think it's the most preposterous thing I've ever heard of, and it made me very angry. I had to pull over to the side of the road to think that we're still worrying about whether we're staring at people's clothing as opposed to trying to help do everything we can to deal with the global warming issue."
That's Barbara Lister-Sink from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. We also heard from Dan Passamato of Portland, Oregon, who said that when he lived in Germany, his neighbor eyed his dryer with derision. She said it was, begging my pardon, typischer Amerikaner. We also heard from everyone, I think, in Bend. Carol Ziogas writes, "I compost in my backyard there. I even run a successful small business devoted to recycling vintage fabrics. Susan's welcome to have tea at my house anytime." Eloise Maddox adds, "Thank goodness I live in the rural part. I may have to look at neighbors' backhoes, but I can have a clothesline." Lynn Cherzanowski of Phoenix, Arizona, wonders maybe there could be a time when lines could be used, say when people are at work. Liz Paul suggested a laundry carousel. It would take up much less space and could be placed in a discreet corner. Abby Addington May remembered her mom in Garden City, Long Island, didn't have a dryer, but she would never hang her laundry on Sunday. That would be discourteous to the neighbors. Rebecca Sherman of Portland, Oregon, says this story precisely keyed on a larger issue, how Bend is conflicted between its exponential growth slash property values and its natural setting slash personal values that make it a desirable place to live. And Susan Chamberlain Lam of Emmaus, Pennsylvania, weighed in as well. She writes she has neighborhood rules, too, but we asked the neighbors if they objected. One wondered if she could beat her rugs on it. The other asked if her boy could use it to make a play tent. "It's free, my children enjoy seeing me hanging laundry outside, and when I sink my nose into a sun-dried sheet, I am again close to my mother." Well, air your thoughts on anything on the show at here-now.org or call 617-358-0397. In a moment, we'll be back with memories of World War II, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've heard this statistic many times. Every day, 1,000 veterans of World War II leave us. Well, the new PBS miniseries, The War, turns its lens on many who are still here to let them tell their story.
I know it's hard to describe what it's really like. You can remember the moments, you see somebody leaving this world. It's not a lot of fun.
That's Ward Chamberlain, one of the founders of PBS and NPR. In fact, full disclosure, a friend of Here and Now who recently visited us for lunch and didn't even mention that he is one of the subjects in the new Ken Burns film, The War. And that's the underlying theme of the film. Until recently, these survivors of World War II didn't talk about it. In 1943, Ward was a volunteer ambulance driver with the American Field Service, and he joins us now in the studio with more of his story of back then. Welcome, Ward.
Glad to be here, Robin.
You know, at one point in the film, you actually say, and this is the first time I'm saying this. And it was when you were telling the story of being an ambulance driver and seeing, you know, the first casualty, the first person who'd been hit.
Well, that first time that I was really in the combat zone, they brought a guy in on a stretcher who was a real mess, and he'd lost an arm already and probably was going to lose a leg and was just hanging on to life for a minute. And I hadn't ever seen anybody in that kind of shape before. And so for just a moment, I leaned around the corner of my ambulance and just let it all come out and quickly. And then in another 10 seconds, then I was fine. But it was really put a shock through my system.
You know, and I just found that remarkable that you hadn't told anyone that. And, you know, we heard from your daughter, Lynn, that she didn't know a lot of the things that you did in the war. My dad, the same way, you know, at Guadalcanal.
Was he at Guadalcanal?
Yeah.
Goodness gracious. We didn't talk about it when we came back from the war. First of all, because everybody told us that we were 3 years behind in catching up with the American competitive race, and we had to rush off to law school or wherever it was. And furthermore, everybody had done their share, and we didn't go into details about what we were doing or what we had done.
Well, I wonder if there were just a couple other factors before we hear more about your war experience. I mean, you know, my late uncle, who liberated concentration camps, said nobody wanted to hear about it. Was that a part of it? Nobody wanted to hear about this awful, awful experience.
That's right.
And then also, it might have been really painful for you guys and women to talk about it, because I guess when Ken Burns was doing interviews, some people who came in to do interviews couldn't do it.
That's right. That's what Lynn Novick, Ken's wonderful co-executive producer, told me, that a number of people that they wanted to get when they put them before the microphone or the cameras just couldn't speak about it.
Well, let's talk about your experience. Growing up, military heroism was a big part of your life. Your father fought in World War One. In fact, you share a story of seeing a priest in New York, and you told him your name, and he said what?
Oh, he said, "That's a wonderful name." He said, "Your father was one of the bravest men I ever knew," which was, you know, pretty touching for me. And
you seemed to get you were very touched by that still.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think one of the reasons that Ken wanted to interview me for this series is because he wanted to show that everybody played their role. You didn't have to get drafted. I had lost an eye with meningitis when I was 11, so that I lost the sight of one eye, so I couldn't get in the regular, you know, the Army or the Air Force or the Marines. And yet I was eager to get into the action of the war.
But to what? To honor your father's service? To
follow
his footsteps?
Well, you always want to do as well as your dad did, or do. If you admire your father, you'd like to come close and at least have some of those experiences. And I found the American Field Service, which had been serving with the British and the French. And I went reported for duty there, and pretty soon I was on my way to the Middle East and off on that extraordinary experience.
Well, you volunteered for this ambulance service.
That's right.
First sent to North Africa, but you had a mild case of polio, and then you were assigned desk duty.
Well, I wasn't about to have that, so I just tore those orders up, and nobody ever saw them. And 2 weeks later, I was on the way to Italy and came in just below Naples.
Well, it speaks to, you know, you and also the men and women of that day that they were running to the front lines there. And you end up in Italy, and there's a couple of horrific events that you witness. One, there was great difficulty. The Allied forces were having a hard time penetrating the German line.
They certainly did.
Yeah. At one point, there was a battle in which the 36th Texas took part, an attempt to cross the River Rapido. Pretty much everyone who tries it is either killed, wounded, captured, drowned. Germans right on the other side, mowing them down. Some did turn around and come back, but they had this emptiness in their eyes.
That's right.
That you saw. Describe that.
Well, I came up in the unit that I was attached to came up to relieve that 36th Division when they were coming out of the line, and one of the most graphic memories of the war for me was to see the look on the faces of these guys as they were coming down the road from the front, putting one foot after another, plodding on, their eyes just glazed over, and because what they'd been through was something nobody else would ever want to go through.
You talked about your reaction to seeing the first really shot-up soldier that you had to treat.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that you didn't see a lot of death. What impact is that, knowing you can't, there's nothing you can do, and that's supposed to be your job, to help these people, nothing you can do.
Yeah. Yes, and, you know, we had terrible conditions in Italy that winter of 1943-44. The mud was knee-high. At one time, one of our ambulances got so badly stuck that we had a couple of Italian bullocks hitched on, and they pulled the ambulance out. We had four-wheel drive ambulances, which were better than anything that the Brits had, and when we came back from the war, this little organization, 2,500 people served in it during World War II, which is in a very small amount.
AFS.
We held the organization together after the war and decided to start a teenage scholarship program. And today, we have 11,000 teenage boys and girls from 55 countries living in a different country, going to school there for a year. And the result's been extraordinary. Our ambassador to the United Nations at the moment is an AFSer, and Nicholas Burns, the Undersecretary of State, is an AFSer. I mean, they've had an AFS experience.
To what end? I mean, what was the...
Well, we hope it'll make for a more peaceful world if people begin to understand at an early age different cultures. I sat next to a young woman the other day, and she didn't know I had any connection with the AFS, and when I said something about it, "Oh," she said, "I lived in Nebraska, and when I was 17, I'd never been out of the state of Nebraska." And she said, "I went to Turkey for a year under the AFS program, and it changed my whole life."
That must help to solve the wounds of the, you know, these memories.
Well, absolutely. It does help. In the war, we helped people. We carried wounded. We helped soldiers, and we saw what remarkable things they did. God knows they did. And so if we can pay it back in some way through this program, why, that's tremendous help.
Yeah. That's former public broadcasting executive Ward Chamberlain, who's now one of the subjects in a PBS film. He speaks about his years serving as an ambulance medic in the series The War. It begins this Sunday. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Ward Chamberlain, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. A great pleasure to be here.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.